Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 405. Sunday, August 8th, 2021.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
About a $100,000 computer, right?
It's soon to be a $20 computer?
No. I mean, it's a decent computer, but I sold 2 Bitcoin to get it.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
At today's price, that's only about, what, $88,000?
Oh, well, hey, you know, that's easy. No problem.
Back in May, it was a $120,000, $130,000 computer.
Yeah. It doesn't count until you sell it.
Mm-hmm. I sold it way too early.
Well, yeah, but now you have a computer.
That's true. That is true. All right. You are listening to another installment of the Sea Realm Vault Podcast. And once again, I'm joined by friend of the podcast, Jim D., your ad attacker. Jim, it's good to hear from you.
Good to hear from you, and also good to be heard.
I don't know if it's the last time you were here, but fairly recently we got together to discuss the book, The Storm Before the Calm, America's Discord, The Coming Crisis of the 2020s, and The Triumph Beyond by George Friedman. And now we're going to talk about a different book by a different author with a pretty different viewpoint, I would say, you know, a different sort of orientation. But the subject matter of the books overlaps very heavily, at least from my perspective. I'm talking about The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good by Michael J. Sandel. And it was actually your suggestion that we discuss this book. So let me ask you, what about the book struck you, and what is it that you want to stress, or how would you want to introduce the audience to the concepts that this book covers?
Okay, well, I remember talking about the Friedman book, and we mentioned the concept of the clerisy. Mm-hmm. These are the people who have the credentials to do the jobs that make the planet go.
Although that's not Friedman's term.
Was that not okay?
No, whose term is that? You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go to my Audible library, and I'm just going to look at my books there and see, you know, if a particular title leaps out at me. Oh, I was kind of on a science fiction bender there for a while. I think that was Joel Kotkin. I think that
Kotkin,
was
yes,
The Coming of Neo-Feudalism, A Warning to the Global Middle Class by Joel Kotkin. I think he's the one that
I'm sorry about that. Yes, I read that as well. In fact, that was the book I read 2 books after Friedman.
Right. So the same thing happens to me. I listen to a bunch of books on similar topics in a short span, and they all just mush together in my head.
Yep. And it's all the same kind of theme, so that's the problem. So it's like, okay, all these guys are talking about this thing. This thing is this thing. So let's get to the clerisy, the Kotkin term. Mm-hmm. Cut the rest of that out in post, I'm sure. Over time, we have evolved in the United States, especially a credentialed class. These are people that have a degree from the right university, and they use that to join a club, essentially. And that club is ruling things. They are heavily represented in government. They are heavily represented in business, especially in finance. And they are even present in the media. Now, this media presence is a really bad thing because the people who are not part of this, well, you can call it clerisy. Another author has called it the episcopacy, because many of them back at the turn of the century were part of the Episcopal Church. But if you're not a part of that, you're not going to get as far in life as one used to be able to go. In fact, here, Sandel notes that 2 of the 4 presidents on Mount Rushmore never went to college.
Those two being?
Let's see. Washington and Abraham Lincoln never went to college.
Aha, uh-huh. Yes.
Abraham Lincoln went to as an apprentice in a law firm. So he bypassed the whole college thing. And in fact, Sandel also notes that the last U.S. president without a diploma, Harry Truman, is generally ranked among America's best presidents. So having a diploma is not necessarily a negative. You can do very well without a diploma, but we have come to a point in our history where if you don't have a diploma, you can't even get into the job. And he opens his book talking about the Varsity Blues scandal, which everybody points out it was horrible cheating that these rich people were able to spend tens of thousands of dollars to get their kid, who wouldn't have gone into the college, into the college. And I saw the Varsity Blues episode, I believe on Frontline or Nova, and it was William Singer who masterminded the whole thing. And he used to tell people, it's like, look, there are three ways of getting into college. You've got the front door. You turn in some really good test scores. You have a lot of extracurricular activity of the right kind, and they grant you a place at the university. Then there's the back door. If you're amazingly wealthy, you can donate a crap load of money. We're talking millions of dollars for some of the Ivy League colleges. And they will say, oh, well, they gave us millions of dollars. Let's give their kid a place in the college. He called his system the side door. And it only cost tens of thousands of dollars. Sandel points out that the scandal was huge because of the cheating. But here's a quote. Equally troubling, however, are the attitudes that fueled the cheating. Lying in the background of the scandal was the assumption now so familiar that is scarcely noticed that admission to an elite university is a highly sought prize. In fact, in the next quote that I have, in securing a place for their kids in prestigious universities, they were buying the borrowed luster of merit.
There's our first mention, other than me, you know, saying it in the title of the book, of merit. You know, we start off with credentialism. And as you say, there's three doors into the elite schools: front door, back door, side door. The front door is the hard one to get through. I mean, lots and lots of people who are academically qualified apply to these schools, and most of them have to be turned away. And there's a very refined application, scrutinizing body and methodology, and they really dig into not just your grades, but also the social aspects of the package. You know, what you did with your summers. Have you done volunteer work? You know, do you have recognized some sort of, you know, teenage credentials outside of school? You know, what volunteer work have you done? Have you, you know, what overseas travel have you done? You know, people have spent a lot of money to get their kids in through the side door with cheating, like, you know, claiming they have athletic prowess in sports that they, you know, they've never really participated in, that sort of thing. But you can spend as much getting in the front door as people do getting in the side door. And in fact, it's very common for people to do so. There are very highly paid admissions consultants who will, you know, partner with the helicopter parents. These people cost tens of thousands of dollars for their services, and they tell you exactly what you need to do to appeal to these admissions bodies. You know, so
yeah, and
lots of money gets spent on this. So that kind of raises the question, if you as a parent have so much money that you can throw tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars at just getting your kid into college, don't you just have the money to set them up with a trust fund?
Exactly.
Right. Yeah, what are they going for? What is it that they really want with that college admission?
Yes, the perception is that without that college admission, the kids are not going to do well. They're not going to get into the best companies afterwards. They're not going to get into government in high places. It has become bragging rights in one set, in one aspect. You can brag that your kid's in Harvard or Stanford or Yale. But on the other side, you have employers that are looking specifically for people who went to college at Harvard and Yale and Penn and Stanford and all the rest. And in fact, Sandel notes that only at a narrow slice of elite colleges have admission rates plunged in recent decades. In 1972, this is when the system that sorts people out and really goes for the cream of the crop, Stanford accepted 1/3 of those who applied. Today, it accepts less than 5%. He also lists a bunch of others with similar declines. The change isn't at Stanford, it's that the number of people who feel going to Stanford is the thing they must do. And this is not reserved for famous people who say rut-row on television. This is across the board. This is a widely held conceit here in the United States. If you don't have an elite education, you're not going to do as well in life.
So I had four terms that were basically written on a piece of paper. This was the extent of my preparing for this conversation. We've tackled two of them, I think. Credentialism and meritocracy. We live in a country where, you know, our self-justifying narrative is that if you work hard, if you are talented, if you are smart, you will succeed. That's meritocracy. Spoils go to those who deserve them.
Yes.
The flip side of that being, if you're not doing well, it's probably because you either made some bad choices or you're just a lazy piece of shit.
Yep.
Either way, the people who have succeeded in life have no responsibility toward you because you made your bed, now lie in it.
And furthermore, the people who succeeded in life deserve to be there so they can bask in the spoils.
Yes. And the Obama administration was replete with Harvardites and Yaleys, and they were, you know, the Obama response to the 2008 crisis and, you know, the economic fallout from that, he took the baton from the Bush administration and ran with it in the exact same direction. And there was just, as Sandel puts it, there was just an assumption on the part of these, you know, these credentialed meritocratic elites that the folks on Wall Street, who are themselves highly educated and supposedly very, very intelligent, they absolutely deserve these huge rewards, even though, you know, their speculative bets failed dramatically.
Yes, they created the system that blew up.
Right, and yet, but they still deserve not only to be rescued, but to be rescued in style.
Yes.
And this is a bipartisan conceit. I mean, this was the passing of the baton from Bush Jr. to Obama, and they didn't miss a beat.
Yeah, and Bush Jr. didn't make any changes from Clinton.
Exactly.
Everything has been moving in this direction on both parties for years. I love this one quote. I don't know if you know who Larry Summers is.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. He's a guy that everybody should hate. I'm going to give you some more reason to hate him in just a minute after I clear my throat. Larry Summers, this is a quote, is an economic advisor to President Obama, put it bluntly, one of the challenges in our society is that the truth is kind of a disequalizer. One of the reasons that inequality has probably gone up in our society is that people are being treated closer to the way that they're supposed to be treated.
Yep. It's so, the natural order, don't you know?
The natural order. So when we're talking about the people on Wall Street, yes, they're supposed to be treated like that. But what he is completely blind to is that when you reverse that, when you look at the people who don't have their credentials, who didn't go to the Harvard degree places, who didn't get into the Obama administration, you're saying everybody is a piece of shit.
Yeah. Smart versus dumb is how Sandel puts it. That's the axis.
Mm-hmm.
And smart people deserve respect and rewards, and dumb people deserve, you know, to be used by the smart people as they will.
Yep, I have the quote right here. Prior to the 1980s, U.S. presidents rarely used the word smart. And when they did, it was typically in the traditional sense, as in an intelligent device, a smart car, a smart freeway, smart weapons, blah, blah, blah. However, the use of the word smart climbed steadily from 1975 to 2008, and then the word dumb increased, it doubled from 2000 to 2018. But as a measure of meritocracy's hold on the public mind, the growing frequency of smart is less revealing than its changed meaning. It increasingly became a general term of praise, a way of arguing for one policy rather than another. As an evaluative contrast, smart versus dumb began to displace ethical or ideological contrasts such as just versus unjust or right versus wrong. And both Clinton and Obama frequently argued that their favorite policy was not just the right thing to do, it's the smart thing to do. This rhetorical trick suggested that, in a meritocratic age, being smart carried more persuasive heft than being right.
Yeah, and you know, that is the ethos of technocracy, which is another term I wanted to introduce. I mean, not that anybody's hearing it for the first time, but dictionary.com defines technocracy as the government or control of society or industry by an elite of technical experts. And, you know, how is one marked out as a technical expert? Well, they have the right credentials, the right degree from the right school, the right accreditation. Mm-hmm. So that is, you know, we have a technocratic, plutocratic oligarchy that, you know, there's another author I'd like to mention. He probably wouldn't fit very well in the same room, you know, with any of these other authors that we're talking about, but I'm talking about Curtis Yarvin, AKA Mencius Moldbug. His word for the clerisy is the cathedral. And when he talks about the cathedral, he's talking about, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post, Harvard, Yale. Basically, it's I think, a pretty close overlap with the clerisy, but he's focusing on the institutions rather than the people.
Yes, and I think it was Sandel, although, as earlier demonstrated, I might be confusing it with another author. He pointed out that when you do a brain scan on a person, if somebody says that they are an expert, our critical brains shut down and we just listen.
Right.
Which means once you get into the clerisy, the episcopacy, the cathedral, you can dictate, you can preach, you can issue edicts, and people will go along with it. Or at least they used to until more recently.
Yes. So when do we talk about the big orange bad?
I was just getting to that.
I thought you might be.
Let's see. Let's get back to a quote here. This is the fun one. This is the fun thing. Hillary Clinton, 2018, was in Mumbai. She was interviewed. Hillary Clinton said of her campaign,
if you look at the map of the United States, there's all that red in the middle where Trump won. I win the coasts. I win, you know, Illinois and Minnesota, places like that. But what the map doesn't show you is that I won the places that represent 2/3 of America's gross domestic product. So I won the places that are optimistic, diverse, dynamic, moving forward, and his whole campaign, Make America Great Again, was looking backwards. You know, you didn't like black people getting rights, you don't like women, you know, getting jobs, you don't want to, you know, see that Indian American succeeding more than you are. Whatever your problem is, I'm going to solve it.
This is what Sandel calls meritocratic hubris, the complete inability to understand why somebody wouldn't like you. And he maintains that this meritocratic hubris was the reason the press completely missed Trump's election. They did not even look at the fact that people they regard as humiliating feel humiliated. And here's another great quote. Even the phrase, quote, our lot in life, unquote, draws in a moral vocabulary that suggests certain limits to unbridled responsibility. To speak of one's lot suggests the throwing of the drawing of lots, a result determined by fate. But if you get into a university because your parents paid tens of thousands of dollars in prepping you for the SAT and getting your transcripts, great. That's not luck. That's not fate. And that's not fortune. You just have rich parents. You are part of the upper class, and you should probably be a little more humble about what comes your way. Otherwise, you're going to piss off a lot of people who are going to vote for the guy with the orange hair.
Yep, and that is a message that people who are trained to the meritocracy are seemingly unable to even apprehend.
Yes.
It's just noise.
And in fact, these people really embrace the idea that everybody can get ahead if they try, because, of course, they tried and they're getting ahead. Sandel teaches at Harvard, and he points out at one point that in China, the current generation of young people are doing better than their parents. there is actually more upward mobility in a communist country than there is at the United States. And he points out that a lot of his students get really defensive when they hear that. They're like, well, no, hang on. I'm here because I worked hard. But he says a few people in the college actually point out that, you know, that might be true, but we shouldn't talk about it because it's probably better that people don't know that. And he refers, that attitude refers to something called Plato's noble lie, something that you lie about just to make sure that you still have social cohesion in your society.
You know, as I re-listened to parts of the audiobook yesterday and this morning, and the bits that I was listening to, you know, I usually don't necessarily go right to the lived experience of the young elites with the helicopter parents, you know, who've been shepherded through an actually rigorous, you know, years-long, very stressful pre-college boot camp. From their perspective, they did work hard. You know, it's like going to boot camp. You know, the drill instructor comes in at 5 o'clock in the morning with a megaphone and shouts at you and you leap out of bed. And from that moment, you know, until you go close your eyes that following evening, you're hustling, you're doing stuff, but you're doing stuff under the direction of somebody who's providing the structure. So yeah, it's hard. And there were people that you were there with who didn't make it, but having that structure, having, you know, being in that pipeline allows you, I mean, one, it helps you to motivate yourself. And two, it provides structure and guidance that no amount of, you know, undirected, unguided thrashing about, no matter how energetic or sustained, is going to achieve. You know, so that sort of strengthens the meritocratic mindset or the meritocratic hubris. Because, you know, from the lived experience of the kids who get into these elite schools, they really did work hard.
Yes.
You know, it would be insulting to them to say, you're only here because you're rich, because that flies in the face of their lived experience. So that's, you know, one, that's like the mortar between the bricks of the meritocracy, is that lived experience of the kids, you know, who were put through all of this. And a lot of Sandel's suggestions are aimed at making the lived experience of the, you know, the children of the elites less heinous, because it really is a very miserable, high stress childhood.
Mm-hmm. It's funny. My wife's cousins both went to Harvard. Their dad was an oncologist of some note. And one, he just tells me, he's like, look, you go to Harvard and you bust your butt and just hit the books and do everything you need to do, you'll probably get an A-. But if you slack off, cut classes, you know, show up hungover most of the time, you'll probably get a B+.
Yeah.
Because none of the professors know which of these people in their hundreds and hundreds of seats lecture halls has parents with the power to make their life miserable.
Right.
And so they tell themselves, because they did have to bust their butt to get there, just like you were saying, they tell themselves that I must keep doing this, and this is going to lead to a life well lived, without realizing that they can take it easy right now. They can take their foot off the gas and, you know, coast for a bit. Once they're in, the chances of getting out are pretty slim.
So in terms of reading other people's words, we've had several voices in this podcast so far, but you took the time to carve out a couple of quotes so we can have actual other voices. So let's go to William Jefferson Clinton and Barack Hussein Obama.
But finally, if we do all that, we'll never be the country we ought to be unless we become the best educated country in the world. The average 18-year-old changes work 8 times in a lifetime, in a world in which what you earn depends on what you can learn.
In the old days, a young person, they might just have followed their parents' footsteps, gotten a job in their parents' line of work, keep that job for 30, 40 years. If you were willing to work hard, you didn't necessarily need a great education. If you'd just gone to high school, you might get a job at a factory or in the garment district, or you might be able to just get a job that allowed you to earn your wages, keep pace with people who had a chance to go to college. But those days are over. And those days are not coming back. We live in a 21st century global economy. And in a global economy, jobs can go anywhere. Companies, they're looking for the best educated people wherever they live. And they'll reward them with good jobs and good pay. And if you don't have a well-educated workforce, you're going to be left behind. If you don't have a good education, then it is going to be hard for you to find a job that pays a living wage.
There we
Basically,
go.
Both of these quotes are just, you know, both presidents saying we got to get everybody to go to college because people who don't go to college are useless.
All right. Here's the first quote. Think about every problem, every challenge we face. The solution to each starts with education. That was George H.W. Bush in 1991. In Britain, Tony Blair in 1996. Ask me for my three main priorities for government. I will tell you education, education, and education. Bill Clinton expressed the importance of education and its connection to jobs with a rhyming couplet. What you earn depends on what you can learn. And he invoked this more than 30 times during his presidency, and it was even echoed by John McCain, who was running against Barack Obama in 2008. Barack Obama, he saw higher education as the solution. If you don't have a good education, then it's going to be hard for you to find a job that pays a living wage. And then he has another couplet of his own. No matter who you are, where you come from, what you look like, this country will always be a place where you can make it if you try.
Right. You know, speaking of overused presidential phrases, there is the notion, I think, introduced by Ronald Reagan. You know, famous conservative, famously against welfare programs, but saying, look, if you're struggling through no fault of your own, that's the key phrase, through no fault of your own, then you do have a legitimate claim on the rest of society. You can ask for help, and we are, you know, bound to give it to you just by the standards of human decency if it's not your fault.
Yes.
But if you're a fuck up, fuck you. Go away and die. We owe you nothing. But who's never fucked up? What person who's on hard times cannot look back and think of something that they could have done differently and had a better outcome?
Right. Do you turn left or turn right at the intersection?
Right.
Well, and one's a fuck up, one's a great.
Exactly.
Just don't know
but
which one.
At the intersection, you know, there's no sign that says turn left and die. And lots of people who turned left did fine anyway, you know?
Yep.
So it basically just denies the ambiguity of luck and says, look, I mean, there's clearly a few sympathetic cases where we don't mind sharing. But we're just going to assume that for most people, particularly the ones that we're not very sympathetic toward, they're fuck-ups and they deserve what they get. Now, that was Ronald Reagan. But through no fault of their own is a phrase that got picked up by the likes of Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, who used it and leaned on it way harder than Ronald Reagan ever did. You know, and I think this is coming back just to the whole continuity of the evolution of neoliberalism.
Yes.
Democrats and Republicans both, they can't even see it. You know, they participate in it so automatically and unthinkingly that they can't even appreciate how thoroughly they're serving the same master.
I'm really curious about this rise because what you were talking about, Sandel notes that there is an entire body of literature called luck egalitarianism, where the lucky get great stuff, but if people through no fault of their own, if they fall on hard times, yes, they should be helped. But it's that test, that did you turn left or turn right at the intersection? My question, and Sandel does not address this really much in his book, if at all, why did the neoliberals who went to college in the 60s suddenly say, we have to focus all of our efforts on making education the sorting process for the next elites? And I can only think that in the 1960s, that's where the television advertising became dominant in campaigns, where people saw that when you spend a lot of money on radio and television, you can win no matter how good a candidate you might be. And I cannot help but think that maybe the neoliberals in the pressure cooker of the Ivy League, with Bill Clinton at one level, with Gary Hart was a big influence there. Also, Paul Tsongas was a big name. They saw the future of campaigning, therefore the future of government, and they had to create a narrative that allowed them to go to not to the $10 picnics where you get $10 a person, but to the $10,000 sit-down plates. They could not insult the people at the 10,000 plate in order to get their money. They had to create this narrative which stoked the egos and increased the hubris of the big donors. Now, Sandel does not talk about this in the book. He only notes that this is happening. But I can't help but thinking that the rise of television maybe led directly to Clinton, to Obama, to Bush, to all of it.
Well, obviously, there's a lot of irons in the fire, a lot of threads in the knot. But, I just think about the dramatically rising cost of college tuition, even for state schools. You know, it used to be that, like, still, it's always been the case that most people don't go to college.
Right.
Increasingly, those who don't go to college have very few prospects for a decent middle class living. But those who did go to college, say in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, they weren't taking on a crippling debt to do so.
It was free.
In many instances, it was free. And in other instances, it was affordable. You know, you could, if you didn't have the money for tuition, you would work a summer job, you know, to pay. Mm-hmm. But, you know, now to go to like an elite school, you know, your summer job better be as a hedge fund manager. Otherwise, there's no way you're making enough, you know. So I think that had a big part in it. The right people were getting paid in pursuit of the other term that I have written down here, which we haven't mentioned yet. And that is the overproduction of elites. Mm. You know, the quotes that we played from Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, they're both saying, look, if you're going to be any significant part of the technocracy or the technocratic economy, you have to go to school. You have to get a college degree, which means you have to take on, in many cases, just crippling levels of debt. So if you take on all this debt, you go to school, but then you don't get a high-paying job, well, you would have been better off not going to school. And so here's the Wikipedia definition of elite overproduction. Elite overproduction is a concept developed by Peter Turchin, who describes the condition of a society which is producing too many potential elite members relative to its ability to absorb them into the power structure. This, he hypothesizes, is a cause for social instability, as those left out of power feel aggrieved by their relatively low status. Turchin said that this situation explains social disturbances during the late Roman Empire and the French Wars of Religion, and predicted that this situation would cause social unrest in the U.S. during the 2020s. Elite overproduction has been cited as a root cause of some political tension in the U.S. as structural racism and other injustices are invoked to explain why so many well-educated millennials are underemployed or otherwise not achieving the status that the narrative of a meritocracy taught them was the expected outcome. So the meritocratic narrative is go to school, study hard, play by the rules, and you know you will go as far as your gifts will carry you. So people do that. They take out the debt, you know, they take on the debt, they get the credentials, but they're not credentials from Yale. They're not credentials from Stanford. They're credentials from the University of Missouri. You know, they're credentials from some state college you've never heard of. They paid money for it. They're still in debt for it, but it's not going to get them a good job. But it does give them the ability to articulate their grievances. You know, they did what they were told was the right thing to do, and now they're suffering for it, but they're literate. You know, they can complain about it in a way that somebody who didn't go to college can't, and they feel aggrieved in a way that somebody who didn't go to college wouldn't. Because the person who didn't go to college, who just got a job and started working, they might not be rich, they might be struggling themselves, but they don't have $50,000 of college debt hanging over their head, you know?
Yep.
So the idea that the only way out, you know, the only solution to all of our societal problems is more and more education for more and more people, you know, as Andrew Yang pointed out, the tech industry is 8% of jobs. It doesn't matter how many people learn to code. That 8% is not going to swell to encompass everybody who needs work. It's not going to happen.
Yep.
You know, so this notion that everybody has to get credentialed up is going to make things worse. I would say has been making things worse because, you know, one of the things that you really learn in liberal arts education these days is how to complain and how to, you know, blame others for your predicament. So people are getting PhDs in that, you know, and there's only so many professorial positions available to teach that skill set. So people go out into the world aggrieved, angry, indebted, but literate, you know, and they look for somebody to blame. And, you know, there's plenty of blame to go around. And I think a lot of the, you know, the finger pointing and the blaming that gets done is misguided. But still, it is a source of social instability and incoherence.
Yes. Sandel is very specific about this, especially near the back of the book, when he says we have to value people who get a Voc-Tech degree as a plumber or an electrician just as much as a PhD in economics. And if we don't do this, we are just going to piss off the people who either, as you said, get the credentials but can't get the fancy job, or never get the fancy credentials in the first place.
Yeah.
It but is undermining society.
Some of that debt. I mean, those are the people who really have it the worst, or the ones who signed up for these for-profit schools, but, you know, some of which are called universities, like University of Phoenix.
Yes.
They pay enormous amounts of money. They get practically no actual education. And they drop out. You know, they don't even have the fake credentials from the fake school, but they have real debt.
Yeah, I'm hoping somebody is going to do something about those places. Those are just a drain on society. I mean, everyone likes to say that any productive activity is productive and it makes the economy go. It's like, no, there's a lot of productive activity that does nothing but take wealth from the economy and completely screw everybody else.
Yeah, but a lot of those parasitic activities require the right credentials.
Yes, they do. Or the right equipment. Yes.
Yeah. Well, anybody can buy the equipment, you know, the rich guy who never went to school and doesn't speak English. And, you know, he grew up in China. He can mine Bitcoin on an industrial scale.
Well, I was thinking of people who set up a auto dialer and spam call as many numbers as they can find.
Yeah.
You know, the costs are negligible. What's that?
Do you get the Chinese robocalls?
Oh, yeah. We get all the robocalls, you know, especially we still have a landline because it's conditional with our DSL. So, yeah. Yeah. We're getting away from Sandel just by mentioning the unproductive education and other alternatives to work. When you were talking about the cost of education, it brought to mind the original thought from Thomas Jefferson. There's a guy named Conant who was the president of Harvard in the early 1940s. Conant was setting up a scholarship program, and he needed a way of giving a test to a lot of different people, as many as they could find, as for as little cost, in order to get really good students that weren't in the Northeast into Harvard. He came from the Midwest. He was a chemistry professor, got to be president of Harvard, and he hated the people that he saw around Harvard, because even in the depths of the Depression, these people, they're all men at that point, lived in a neighborhood called the Gold Coast. They had money. They had butlers. They had servants. They were more interested in going to a football game or a cricket match or whatever than going to class. He hated them, and he wanted to put more students in Harvard who actually were smart. And he picked up Thomas Jefferson's plan. Jefferson wrote in letters to John Adams saying how we should select people from the lower ranks and give them a state-sponsored education just to get more diversity. Well, he didn't use that term, but a different voice in government, a different voice in the civil service and in business. However, he put it this way: 20 of the best geniuses will be raked from the rubbish annually and be instructed at the public's expense. Raked from the rubbish.
Yep.
Conant, in another book I'm reading concerning the SAT, said, "I was never so crass as to use that language." So he didn't quote Jefferson, but he agreed with it.
Right.
So in the early days, the SAT, which was based on the Army exam, it's a huge history that I'm getting into right now. It was a cheap way of giving a lot of people either an aptitude test or an intelligence test. Now, aptitude says you do well in school. IQ test says because you did well at the test, you're smart. That is a complete misnomer. There's no such thing as a written intelligence test. It just doesn't exist. But this was the height of the eugenics movement. They really wanted to get the right people into school to offset the college preppy jerks and make sure that the people that were flooding into the United States in great numbers didn't take over. One of the side effects of our sequestration during COVID is the fact that the few non-COVID bugs that usually went around and affected people just a little bit are now superbugs themselves. And there has been a coughing and hacking non-COVID thing going around that's been just bugging us for weeks. We lost our herd immunity of the common cold.
Well, I begrudgingly admit that I'm lucky to be here in Vermont. I haven't been sick in forever, because I'm not exposed to any humans, really. I walk to the store once a day, but I'm not in close contact with anybody. So, which, it's my own personal experience of what I think has just been, an acceleration of all of the madness inducing currents of recent years, for a couple decades now. I think the Republican Party has been openly embracing conspiracy theories, to pander to their constituency. But in the Trump years, the Democrats joined them, and just no conspiracy is too batshit insane, for respectable people to endorse it. And then, after 4 intense years of crazy, crazy conspiracy gibberish, coming out of not just Fox News, but also MSNBC or CNBC. I'm not sure how those two are related. I know that they are. But, after all of this crazy making and just, the crazy making and the, autopilot gaslighting of the social media companies, then we get this lockdown where everybody is isolated and, isolating people, physically isolating animals, makes them easier to train. Mm-hmm. It makes, you can remove distracting sensory influences, put them in a quiet, controlled environment, and then you control the sensory stimuli and, you get to more effectively condition their behavior. And we've all been thrown into that. Like on top of all the other crazy making stuff going on in our lives, add to that a year and a half now of social isolation. So really all you have to interact with other people is this crazy machine, the worldwide crazy web and, the web of a million nutty conspiracy theories.
And now the social media companies that are behind the crazy machine are completely reversing course, and you now have Dwisbins, as Chris Martinson said, the drugs which shall not be named.
What are they?
Oh, that would be hydrochloroquine and ivermectin.
Okay.
These are, and you get the crazy on both sides, like you were saying. You get the Fox crazy, you get the conservative crazy, and you get the other crazy on the other side, and there are lies on both sides. And just not just lies, but official, this is policy, we will do this, and it's based on a lie. And I am like with you, I am sick of the fact that I can't look at any situation without saying, okay, where's the lie? I don't trust anything anymore. It's right. Horrible.
And, a certain baseline of incredulity, I think, is healthy. I mean, that's just healthy skepticism, but it can easily be taken too far. And, the further you take it past the point of diminishing returns, the more you're pushing into the realm of, disintegrating the social cohesion that is absolutely necessary for a nation of hundreds of millions of people to continue existing.
Yes, we have reached a point of epistemological vacuity. we have no experts that we can trust. So we're all on our own reading as much stuff that doesn't look crazy, we hope, and we hope not to find out that is completely nonsense.
But, you know, it looks less crazy than the other stuff because it flatters us in the right places up front.
Exactly. It's part of our filter bubble. It fits with all the other bubbles I have going in my head. And if you get a lot of bubbles, what do you have? Froth. Sandel emphasizes near the end of his book that the liberal emphasis on distributive justice, this is where we start saying we need to get people of color, we need to get women, we need to get LGBTQ into the few remaining spots of coolness, and maybe the white man needs to step back a little bit. He says it rightly offers a counterweight to, you know, the ongoing history of the United States, which, as everybody pointed out, was white male. Okay, fine. But he also says that all of the presidents so far have emphasized maximizing gross domestic product. That's a mistake, because the focus on maximizing gross domestic product puts the emphasis on consumption rather than production. So we are invited to think of ourselves as consumers and not producers. He says, of course, in practice, we are both. We want to get the most from our money as consumers, and as producers, we want satisfying and well-paying work. But the elites who presided over globalization not only failed to address the inequality it generated, they also failed to appreciate its corrosive effects on the dignity of work. We all need to know that we are doing good work, that we have good work to do. He calls that contributive justice. This is where you focus not on an elite meritocracy, but see society as a cohesive whole where some people do thinky work and some people do dirty work, but everybody does work that contributes to society. And without it, we have the situation we have today where people are dying deaths of despair, drinking too much, shooting too much, smoking too much, and just dying because nobody cares. And now deaths of despair outweigh heart disease, which was the traditional killer of people in the past. He also points out that the former president with the orangish hue really got most of his support from places that tracked very highly on deaths of despair. So this was his evidence. It's like, look, guys, we are creating an unstable social network that we need to reverse. And if we don't, it's just going to go tits up real quick.
As so often happens, I'm reminded of a quote, and I can't remember who said it or where I heard it, but somebody was summarizing the electoral appeal of Donald Trump just by saying that the people who voted for Trump were looking to vote for the craziest son of a bitch on offer. Just whoever was least like the supposedly acceptable candidates,
yes, you
know, of the mainstream, whoever breaks as far from that mold as possible is the person they're going to gravitate to. It's like,
yes, yeah. I have talked to people who have said exactly that. In fact, one guy, a former Marine, said his vote for Trump was a hand grenade thrown to the system. Yeah. He wanted to upset the apple cart. No, he wanted to destroy the apple cart.
Lannister, Targaryen, Baratheon, Stark, Tyrell. They're all just spokes on a wheel. This one's on top, then that one's on top, and on it spins, crushing those on the ground.
It's a beautiful dream. Stopping the wheel. You're not the first person who's ever dreamt it.
I'm not going to stop the wheel. I'm going to break the wheel.
So people who have that type of anger at the system from the meritocratic, technocratic perspective, you know, they must be Nazis or some sort of racist militia types. You know, they're not normal people. They certainly don't have legitimate concerns or, you know, quarrels or grievances.
That is the meritocratic hubris, to assume that you are right and they are wrong, and looking at the only differences that you can see, which usually are racist, nationalist, but you don't consider the legitimate complaints. You don't even recognize that they exist, because that would undermine your entire mythos. It undermines everything that you think got you to the top.
So we were going in a good direction there. We were looking at Sandel's proposed solutions. Maybe we should get back to that.
Let's get back to that. Yeah. One of the big proposals that I liked, he summed up as an admissions person at Yale said, you know, sometimes I think if I can take, you know, once we weed out the people that obviously aren't going to do well in college, we have like, you know, a few thousand applications that we have to look through and we have to judge, take a few hundred from that pile. I just want to throw the whole thing down a staircase and pick them up randomly. And Sandel says, let's do that.
Yeah.
Let's have half of the people that go to the Ivy League be granted a scholarship based on a lottery. Let's have half of them be from the wealthy, from the people who can afford it, and the other half be from whomever, and give them scholarships because they're not going to be able to afford the massive crushing debt. Only the people who, you know, give the endowments and everything, they can afford that, but that'll pay for the college. Everyone else will just come from, well, every walk of life and get there by random chance.
You know, I introduced this conversation by comparing Sandel's book that we've been talking about, The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good, with George Friedman's book, The Storm Before the Calm. And I don't have the full title at the ready, but George Friedman, unlike so many, you know, prognosticators of doom who are known to, you know, the CROM audience, I'd say he's a pretty optimistic guy. He's just, you know, taken a square look at all the troubles that we face and where they come from and, you know, the real difficulties in dealing with them. But he comes to the conclusion that, yeah, the 2020s are going to be a shit show, but thereafter we're going to find a new coherence, a new stability, and things are going to start getting good again in 2030 or thereabouts. And, you know, that's a message that the Chris Martinsons of the world aren't really interested in purveying, or, you know, certainly Jim Kunstler has no interest in a message like that. And, you know, people who are attracted to the searing criticism of the system, which, you know, entails its imminent downfall and, you know, permanent unrecoverable downfall. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't really have much interest in Friedman, but I do. And, you know, Friedman has got a whole chapter on the dysfunction of the university system. And he's got a number of, you know, recommendations of what he thinks needs to be done to fix it. And, you know, he talks about being a college professor, how it's the highest paid, highest status part-time job in the world.
Yep.
And, you know, he talks about the insane value of the real estate that these elite schools are on. And, you know, how spending so lavishly on real estate, groundskeeping, architecture, extravagant salaries for part-time employees, huge amounts of money spent on sports, things like that, that, you know, there's actually very little money. If you take all of that, there's very little money actually going toward education. And you could take that same amount of money, the same amount of resources, you know, the same amount of capital. And if you were interested in using it to educate the populace, well, you sell off that expensive real estate. Adjunct professors, which are basically, you know, guys holding the cardboard sign by the side of the road, will teach undergrads for food. They burn out very quickly because they have such a heavy workload and they're so undercompensated. And he's saying, look, you can just, you don't even have to make it equal. Just kind of balance out the gross injustice of, you know, the distribution of rewards in the collegiate system. And you have a ready body of highly qualified teachers who can teach a lot more students than are currently served by these institutions. And to me, that's just self-evidently true. But if you get rid of the immaculate, beautifully landscaped campuses, you know, there goes part of the allure of the, you know, the elite schools. And he makes the, you know, common sense observation that, hey, I've been to a variety of schools. Some of them were brick buildings in New York City at, you know, the New York City Community College system. And I didn't notice any difference in the quality of instruction between classes attended that I attended there and ones where I attended on these beautiful campuses. But it is the beauty of the campus, which gives some of the mystique to a place like, you know, Harvard. Or the nastiest example is Yale because of where it's located, because, you know, what New Haven, Connecticut looks like off of the Yale campus. But the campus itself, mwah, you know, Garden of Eden. It's also a system of concentric walls because, you know, it is a New Haven, Connecticut.
Right. I have to ask where George Friedman came from, because it sounds like a lot of his architectural criticism comes from somebody from the Eastern Bloc. I remember reading that chapter in his book and thinking, okay, we sell off the Harvard and Yale's campuses and move everybody into fluorescent lighting, false ceilings. We take over strip malls and call that a college. It's like, you just don't have any appreciation for the built environment, dude.
So he's from Hungary.
Okay, there you go. Yeah, Eastern Bloc. So slab, concrete construction, you know, poor assembly, you know, get it done quickly. Jim Kunstler has a lot to say about, you know, energy and everything. But, boy, his commentary on the built environment is spot on. You need a place that's lovable or else you're not going to love being there.
But, you know, there is a balance to be struck between, you know, Soviet era brutalist poured concrete monstrosities and lavish, just gorgeous campuses. I mean, it's an easy transition, I guess, to go from the Stanford campus to, you know, Google headquarters or the Facebook headquarters. You know, they are equally park-like, immaculate, you know, well-appointed, but that's not necessary. I mean, it would be great if everybody could live like that. I visited the Google headquarters in New York City, and man, it was nice. You know, just, they have these kitchen nooks, which are just, there's well stocked with all kinds of stuff. There's nobody working there. You just go in, take what you want. And there was this lovely rec room with like, you know, not just ping pong and pool, but all kinds of sort of exotic games that people could play. And the place was empty. Everybody was in their cubicle typing away.
Yep. I drive by the Kirkland campus on a daily basis. And it's completely empty, but they have these big windows so you can see into their recreational and gathering spaces. And of course, everybody's working from home.
Oh.
So I don't know. In the case of a lockdown and a sequestration, wonderful architecture is really lost. The only people I see working right now are the people that maintain the shrubbery along the side of the road. But that's just a sign of the craziness of today's time. You take away the architecture and it does lose its luster. I agree with that. I think the solution to that is make sure that everybody has good architecture. And to do that, we would have to totally change the tax structure of the United States, which is probably beyond the scope of this conversation.
Yeah, but I like that. Everybody should have good architecture. I'm not going to go so far as to say that it's a human right, because I think we've had human rights inflation, you know, to an unhelpful level.
Yes.
But, yeah, that would sure be nice. I have no objection to it.
That would be cool. We can get rid of the strip malls. Just first off, first thing we do is like, we're going to turn this into, I don't know, bowling alleys. But anyway. So yeah, getting more people into college, reducing meritocracy, raising the value of productive work, all good ideas.
Well, what Sandel says, I think his ultimate cure, or, you know, remedy, is that we've got to structure the economy so that people who don't go to college can have a dignified life and make a decent living.
Absolutely. And we used to have that.
Exactly. That exists in the living memory of people our age and older. So it's not yet at the point where you can say, well, that's impossible.
Correct.
A generation from now, the elite will be able to say, well, that's impossible. That just can't happen. That's never happened in the history of humanity. It never will happen. There's no point in pining for that. But right now, we have the post-World War II boon that we can look back on and say, no, look, there's dumb, lazy, you know, just industrious enough to get up and go to the factory and turn the wrench. There's a guy who sent his kids to college, who owns his house, you know, who got married and stayed married for decades because, you know, it's usually money that breaks up marriages. And as Harriet Fraud likes to say these days, you know, given the economic circumstances of so many men, you know, most women don't really have much use for them. They might have sex with them, but they certainly don't want to live with them. And they're not going to marry them, for God's sake. You know,
woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle. Yeah. Yes, indeed.
Well, economically speaking, you know, for a great many men and women these days, that has become true.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's kind of my next shows will deal with that topic, that changing narrative of the value of work and what you do to work. I'm sitting here wearing a union t-shirt, so I'm part of the old days, I guess. I mean, I have lots of friends at work who put their kids to some pretty elite colleges just by working a little overtime. It does exist. It's a very restricted sliver of society, but it still exists, and they're hiring.
Yeah, it's a lot like the whole universal healthcare notion. It's like, you look at some Americans or you mention it to them and they're like, they look at you like you're from the moon or from Mars. It's like, there's absolutely no way. It's completely unworkable. There's no way to pay for it. Can't happen. But just look north. There's Canada and they're doing it.
They've been doing it.
You know?
And their costs are lower and their outcomes are better.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's not necromancy.
Necromancy would be easier than convincing these people, but yes, the actual act of giving health care for all would be easy and we would be better off for it.
Well, it depends what you mean by we, because, you know, the folks at the pharmaceutical companies, they've got a good thing going.
Do you think they listen to this podcast?
No, they do not.
I think we're safe saying we.
I think you're right. All right. Well, Jim, let me offer you the last word.
Well, last time I think I closed with spatula.
Okay.
Today, I think it should be Wankel rotary engine, even though that's three words. It just sounds funny.
Well, you can hyphenate it. What is it again?
Wankel rotary engine.
Wankel?
That's what powered the old Mazdas.
Oh. News to me.
Well, you know. We had a few Mazdas growing up.
Do you follow electric vehicle news in the broad or, you know, in the main like you used to?
I dip a toe.
You keeping up with battery technology?
That is accelerating quickly. It's pretty amazing. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, there have been really cool batteries with impressive statistics in the laboratory, you know, for many years. But they don't necessarily scale up because of production difficulties or because they're too expensive. But now I think there are some, I forget which company it is. One of the big, like not a total EV company, but, you know, an established company that's getting into EVs has got a model rolling out with a solid state battery.
Ooh. Yeah, the non-chemical batteries. That's like the holy grail because there's no degradation over time. You don't have the exothermic problem of the batteries getting too hot. What's that?
The dendrite formations.
Dendrite formations are a big deal. Yeah. Somebody had a wonderful blog post years and years and years ago about how to imagine the dendrite problem. But I could not sum that up quickly. Yeah. At work, we have an electric. And sadly, you don't want to get a bunch of people who are really into electric vehicles but have never built a bus and get them to build a bus.
What will they do wrong?
They will do everything wrong. In fact, I remember qualifying on the bus and I had to stop the bus and have my instructor look at this thing. That is going to kill someone. It wasn't even subtle. It was like, you got to be crazy. Well, their factory exploded during a heat wave. All the batteries exploded. Yeah. And we thought, oh, finally, we don't have to drive them anymore. So battery technology can be good. So we don't have to drive those crap buses anymore. They have terrible batteries. It's wonderful. From my perspective, I'm sorry. It's something I've been dwelling on lately.
So it looks like it's Toyota. They've announced a prototype that's going to be powered by solid state batteries by the end of this year.
So a big condenser.
You know, I don't have the, I'm not fresh on the technical specifics of their battery.
Wow.
Probably
most people with chemistry degrees aren't fresh with that battery.
Yeah, but there was a time when I watched two or three videos about it with, you know, before smoking weed and actually remembered some of what I heard. And I, at the time, probably could have sounded smart. you know, just regurgitating stuff from the videos, but that's been a few weeks. What's interesting, though, is I think that, you know, there are Chinese electric car companies which have very low production costs, and they're selling cars, you know, they're aiming to sell cars in the $5,000 range. And right now they're selling cars like in the $12,000 to $15,000 range in China. But I think they're going to be coming to the U.S. and they are going to eat the lunch of not only Tesla, but of the, you know, the big established players who are getting into EVs.
Yeah. They also, they have a city, I can't remember which city it is. They have like 5,000 electric buses. And these are buses that don't have they have a sophisticated charge system. You pull up to a stop, people get on and off, and it's like halfway charged by the time you're rolling away.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a powerful inductive at the zone. So no contact is made. I mean, you have other worries about electromagnetic fields, but it works, and they are moving to a full electric fleet in a couple of years. You know, U.S. doesn't even have 5,000 electric buses anywhere. This one has it in one city.
And they've got the infrastructure to support it.
Well, they built the infrastructure. They didn't have it there before.
Right. But yeah, I mean, that's part of the advantage of starting, you know, late, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Being well, and also having a funding system that is very different from ours. They essentially just print money to build things. Here in the U.S., we print money to bail banks out of their own stupid mistakes.
Yes. And maybe they'll make some loans to construction companies and, you know, real estate developers in the process. But
oh, actually, no, they don't do that anymore. They're upfront with there's no more loans to make. But if you stop giving us the money, everything's going to collapse. They're just really holding a grenade or at the children's head and say, look, I can pull this pin anytime you like. Yep. Just keep bringing the goodies.
You know, I agree, and I'm angry about it. I wouldn't for a moment say that the Chinese system is more resilient or coherent. You know, they just prioritize creating a lot of jobs.
Sure.
They know that if there's a lot of unemployed people, that that's going to create social instability. And, you know, the Chinese, despite their many, many blind spots and their particular brand of megalomania, they recognize that desperate, unemployed, hungry people are impossible to govern.
Unemployed and unmarriable.
Yeah. Oh, well, there's not a lot they can do about the gender imbalance at this point.
Oh, they're doing quite a bit. you know, stealing women. They're doing
that. Yeah, but stealing women for the children of elites. I mean, they're not stealing women.
We have to start somewhere. You have 10 million who can't get a wife.
Yeah.
You start with the elites, and hopefully it trickles down.
No, sex robots. That's their only way out.
Anthony Burgess wrote a sci-fi book in the 1950s called The Wanting Seed. Mm. And it focuses on two brothers. One, he has a horrible marriage. And the other is just gay because it's the thing to be because there's an overpopulation problem. And right at the beginning of the book, the population bomb goes off and suddenly you're back in the Stone Age. And suddenly the screw-up brother, now he can't find a wife. And the other brother comes out and it's like, oh yeah, I'm married now. We have several kids. It's like, it's the fashion, you know, one day you breed, one day you don't.
Burgess once said, I have spent the last 25 years thinking that the wanting seed could, in my leisurely old age, be expanded to a length worthy of the subject. Huh.
So apparently it's a short book.
Yeah, his novel didn't really cover the territory the way he wanted to.
Well, his books did get longer and longer as he aged. I'll say that. I read about 10 of them. And
I've only read A Clockwork Orange.
Which one?
The European one, the one with the...
Good.
You know, not the one where he's granted power and then he's just, you know, a rapist with a license. That's the penultimate chapter. That's the one.
That is. Yeah, exactly.
That's where Stanley Kubrick said, yep, that's the end.
Well, this is the weird thing. He got the American version, which lacks the 22nd chapter.
Yeah.
And he shot it in England. where you could go to the bookstore and buy the 22nd chapter right there.
And
he
you
just
think
didn't
somebody
know.
On set would have read the book.
You think? I don't know. But he didn't know it existed.
Yeah. Oh, he didn't?
No. I don't believe he did. I believe he thought this was the book.
So for people who don't know what we're talking about, there's the book, A Clockwork Orange, by Anthony Burgess. And it was made into a film, A Clockwork Orange, which you've surely seen, directed by Stanley Kubrick. But the book has one more chapter than the version that was adapted to the screen. And in the final chapter, Alex grows up. He gets bored with having unaccountable power and being able to brutalize and rape people, you know, to classical music. And he, you know, he decides he's going to get married and have a kid and be a good dad.
Yeah, but that version did not come out in the United States.
Right. Yeah. The U.S. publisher basically cut that final chapter. They thought it was too saccharine.
It was the whole key of the book, but yeah. They thought it was horrible.
Right. I mean, Burgess's point is that, you know, unless he does change, he wasn't really free.
Right.
And he had all these changes imposed on him, but, you know, in the end, it's his own choice. It is his own maturation, which really cures him of being this psychopath.
Right, maturation. I mean, Alex was 15 in the book.
Yeah.
And people grow up and they stop doing stupid kid shit. And that was his theme. It was like, everybody's going to grow up. We'll get past this. But no, we're just going to chop that. And then Stanley Kubrick, hey, this is a great book. Let's make a movie. Whee!
Let's make it as cynical as possible.
Well, Stanley Kubrick, come on.
But what an amazing film.
Anyway. Oh, yeah.
Okay, we're definitely just drifting at this point. So.
Sandel.
No, I think we covered it. I think it's good.
There's a lot in that book that we didn't cover, but that's cool. Yeah, we got the bullet points.
You know, I actually have bullet points. So just to recap, meritocracy, technocracy, credentialism, overproduction of elites.
Yeah, I focused on contributive versus distributive, hubris, and the nemesis of the reaction against. The nemesis would be the reaction against the hubris of the elites. Mm-hmm. Remember, nemesis and hubris were twins or something like that in Roman mythology. I think nemesis was a goddess. That was the person that was sent out to destroy people with hubris who questioned the will of the gods.
Ah. Let's see. Let's ask the internet. The complex involves a combination of hubris, a pretension toward an arrogant form of godliness, and nemesis, a vengeful desire to confront, defeat, humiliate, and punish an adversary, especially one that can be accused of hubris. The combination has strange dynamics that may lead to destructive, high-risk behavior. Oh, and this is not a link to Wikipedia, but a link to www.rand.org.
Oh, God. Ein Volk, Ein Reich, Ein Rand. Okay.
Well, I don't think the Rand Corporation has anything to do with Ein Rand.
Oh, the Rand Corporation. Oh, yeah. No, you're right. Why is the Rand Corporation talking about hubris and nemesis?
I'm looking at the front page of this report, Rand. Beware the hubris-nemesis complex, a concept for leadership analysis by David Rohnfeldt, prepared for the Office of Research and Development, Central Intelligence Agency, National Security Research Division.
Oh, okay. The Rand. These are the advisors to the Foreign Service and the intelligence agencies. Those people. Okay. For some reason, I was thinking it was an electronics company.
No, it is a...
That makes a lot more sense.
Social control and military strategy think tank.
Okay. I guess if you know what you're doing writing things, that would be a job to get. Yeah.
All righty. Well, hey, Jim, I'm gonna turn around and start editing right now and put this thing up on the RSS today.
Oh, well, it's been fun.
Yeah, always, as always. Thank you much. Talk to you again soon.
Thank you. Later.